You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
Hey, Power Athlete Nation. Welcome to another episode of Power Athlete Radio. Today, we are joined by Dr. Allison Bragger. Allison is a two-time alum of Power Athlete Radio. In 2015, when we caught up with her, she was doing her postdoctorate work and recently released a book on TBIs and concussions. Since that time, she's joined the U.S. Army and become the subject matter expert for the U.S. Army in behavioral genetics, sleep, and biological rhythms research. She is passionate about all things sleep and fitness, still continues to train, and is getting ready to deploy. And we get into a stuff about her becoming an astronaut. She was on NASA's pipeline and is going to get a chance to maybe potentially go out and become an astronaut. So not only an amazing discussion, some amazing information on sleep, but also she promised that when she's in town next, we're going to sit down here at Power Athlete Radio. So until then, she's calling in from Fort Bragg and she's getting ready to deploy. So buckle up and prepare for some amazing information on sleep with Dr. Allison Bragger. Hey, welcome to another episode of Power Athlete Radio. We're joined again by our good friend, Miss Allison Bragger. And as you can see from the video, she's in her fancy, well, not her real fancy dress, just her more multicam with obviously her raspberry beret. So good to see you.
Raspberry beret. That's the first I've heard of that. I love that.
It's good. Every time I see him, all I can do is think of that Prince song, you know, the kind you wear in a second, or you find at a secondhand store. And I always thought it was funny, but nobody in the military thinks it's funny.
I think it's hilarious. So, but I'm not your standard military person. So.
That is 100% true. And Allison and I had the distinction of speaking together at a recent summit at Fort Bliss for the H2F summit. And it was great because we obviously got to reconnect on her podcast that she did like 7 years ago, 8 years ago, but then also what she's doing since then. And I'd love to get into more of your presentation and what we discussed about sleep and really just catch up with what you're doing and, you know, working for your crown of probably the most interesting woman in the world.
Well, I think you're the most interesting person in the world. So I guess we share that commonality.
Stop. Okay. Okay, cool. So what's going on? I mean, obviously you're still at Fort Bragg and the next jaunt is on to Southern Florida. So what's going on?
Oh, it's, you know, honestly, I've been living the dream in this job. It's really nice to work for a community that appreciates the pursuit of excellence. You know, the last time I was on the podcast, I wasn't in the military, but I decided to make that transition back to the military. And, you know, it's been good for me culturally. I think I finally found my group of people. Not to say I wasn't successful in academia, but I just, you know, culturally, I didn't identify with a lot of people who are professors and researchers. You know, all they do is work. They don't really have a good work-life balance, and any sort of balance they have outside of work is not centered around fitness and health. So it's been really awesome to, you know, the last 6-7 years just grind and row really hard and, you know, do it with a group of people who are like-minded and all about health and fitness.
So you've become the Army's expert, it's fair to say, on sleep. At least from the presentation, that's what I got. And, you know, going through and just speaking to certain people, I thought it was hilarious that, you know, we give these presentations and, you know, for all the good information, we have Flo Groberger, who won the Medal of Honor, come out and he basically just hands it out. He was wearing it and hands it out and everybody kind of passed it around. And I thought to myself, man, what a huge a trump card to hand out the Congressional Medal of Honor and just let people like everybody look at it. It really didn't matter what he had to say. And I don't know if he even prepared anything, but anything after that's pretty good.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I saw you did what I did, which is take a picture of it. And you're like, damn, this is like the one and only time I'll ever get to hold one.
Yeah, no, that was pretty neat. But I mean, I'd love to get into more of the sleep stuff. I mean, there was so much good information and You know, whether it be Doc Parsley and other people, they kind of throw out these tidbits, but your presentation was excellent, where it really gave some defined things for people to follow, like, you know, no technology, 60 minutes, turn off TV, 90 minutes. I mean, you know, the piece you did on energy drinks, actually killing brain cells and making people dumber was great. I've been saying that for years. So I'd love to get in a little bit on that presentation and just some of the low hanging fruit and some of the things that you found. And I find it most interesting because the community you work for is very, what is it, directive actioned, where, hey,
that's one of their warfighting functions, yeah, actually.
And it makes sense. I mean, like, they don't live in gray space. And it's like, well, you know, I think you kind of need 6 or 7 or 8 hours. It's kind of like, no, you have to do this and this. And they function much better that way with really kind of firm guardrails. And this is where I need you to be. And that's what I really appreciated about your talk was that, you know, here are the guardrails. This is what we've seen. This is the research. And if you want to optimize health and performance and longevity and be the best version of your job, follow these guidelines.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I think one of the things I've had to learn being in the Army, it was sort of a challenge for me at first, but I quickly picked up on it, is even as an expert, you have to present it like you're a coach, right? Because at the end of the day, a lot of the people in our formation have played sports or live, breathe, and eat around sports. And so approaching any sort of complex material, educational material, is better received if you come at it like you're a coach and not a teacher or lecturer or professor. Like, you're going to lose them right there. So I always try to, with each presentation, like, take the best science out there, but then really think about how it matters to that particular unit. So, you know, I might have like a blanket presentation I use for sleep, because I do a lot of these leadership professional development talks, but I also try to think about what's important to that particular unit and their mission, and then tailor the content accordingly. Because that's really, at the end of the day, it's not for me, it's for them. And however they're able to get buy-in in order to implement and institute these practices, that's what matters, you know?
Yeah. Okay. So there's obviously different populations. You know, you're at Fort Bragg right now, and, you know, these guys are obviously in kind of a training workup, and the Army is really interesting. This was, you know, having never been in the Army, but worked pretty extensively with the Army, I was amazed that the Army is a lot like a corporation. There were secretaries, there were guys that fixed the trucks and the generator mechanics, and then the warfighters. And it's just kind of an interesting collection, like a corporation, where there's all these different jobs to do. But everybody has to maintain a certain level of fitness associated with a PT test, or now the new ACFT that, I mean, obviously the standards are a little bit different for somebody in the secretary pool opposed from, you know, somebody trying to kick indoors. But everybody has to have a certain level of readiness and be in shape. So as you tailor these prescriptions to different people, is it, you know, hey, you're back, you're, you know, at Fort Bragg, you're on base, this is what your job looks like, opposed from somebody that's going to go, you know, obviously get deployed somewhere and maybe potentially go outside the wire?
Yeah, I mean, that's right. Fitness, there's a reason why we practice functional fitness, right? And I think the Army has finally gotten it right. You know, you think about, God, I wasn't even in the Army yet when they started revamping and revising the PT test to justify why the ACFT would be the way ahead. If you remember, it started with the OPAT, the Occupational Fitness Physical Assessment Test, which they were using all the movements of the ACFT to use that as a predeterminant for somebody's MOS. I think, you know, we're in a new wave and a new era for the Army in terms of fitness. I think what was done before, it was good enough for maintenance, but it wasn't good enough for optimization. And I think that's really where we're headed now with everything. And it's going to translate, and it's going to pay off dividends when it, you know, does need to be exercised when and where in war. Like, it's inevitable we'll go to war again. You know, we don't have a prediction or timeline, but given the history of the world and our country, like, it's going to happen again. But I think the next generation and formation of our troops will be better prepared with this new test than they ever have in the past, because you have to work, right? You can't just get by, and you can't, you know, there are a lot of medical officers who, leading up to the old Army test, would severely diet and calorie restrict and then try to get in shape within 3 weeks of taking the test. And then they would fall off the wagon again and have poor eating habits, not work out, and then do that again 6 months later. You can't hide with this test. You truly have to work out every single day or have a training periodization plan in order to pass this test. And I do love that the Army's just, you know, laying down the hammer and going forward with it.
I couldn't agree more. So in 2015, when we spoke last and you'd written your book, you know, about head trauma and some of the things that we're going through, you were, I would call you a professional CrossFitter working on your PhD and doing this. Had you not been in the Army at that point?
No, I hadn't. Yeah. So that was, I was doing my postdoc. So I had already got my PhD. I was doing my fellowship in Atlanta. No, I basically did a secondary postdoctoral fellowship with the Army. So my plan was to stay at Morehouse School of Medicine, join there as faculty. But I was uncomfortable with the instability of living and dying by grants. Basically, in that world, if you don't have a grant, you're out of a job. Even if you're a good lecturer, a good researcher, it doesn't matter. You're not bringing money in. So thank you for your service. Goodbye. So I couldn't deal with that instability. So I did a secondary postdoc fellowship at Walter Reed. And my first day there, they asked me if I wanted to direct commission.
Oh, wow. Okay. And then you said, sure, let's do it.
Yeah. I mean, so I always wanted to serve. I wanted to go to West Point for undergrad. I got in, but you know, our country went to war in 2002, the year I graduated. So my parents were like, absolutely not. You're not allowed to go to the Naval Academy, not going to West Point. Part of me wonders if that did save my life, because, you know, there were quite a few fallen soldiers from the war during those last years at West Point. But, you know, I always just kept that in the back of my mind afterwards that I just had a propensity to serve. And I had that opportunity when I went to Walter Reed to work.
Oh, okay. For some reason, I thought that you had done something prior service, went out and got, and then they kind of pulled you back in. So, I mean, that's incredible.
Well, I did. So in college, I did. I was doing officer candidate school with the Marines.
It was. Okay. Okay.
I was doing officer candidate school with the Marines. And then, so I ran track and field at Brown. I was a D1 college athlete. I say that because my sophomore year, I had a foot injury and it was a stress fracture. It wasn't even a stress fracture. It was a stress reaction. And the Marines was like, nope, sorry, you can't be an officer anymore. Literally, like, okay, I'm D1 track and field, Ivy League educated. I can't be an officer because, heaven forbid, I'm competing at the highest level in college and I got a stress reaction. That's literally what happened.
What did you run in college? What events?
I was a hipped athlete, and okay. Then I did the pole vault and the 400 hurdles, which is the most painful event in track.
Yeah, I was going to say you're pretty much at the tip of the spear in athleticism, you know, with the I mean, really the pole vault I think is probably the greatest display of athleticism I've ever seen. Like, I'm going to sprint as fast as I can with this, you know, 20-foot stick made of fiberglass. I'm going to put it in a little tiny hole. I'm going to lean back and catapult myself over a, you know, very loosely placed bar, and then somehow figure out how to not break my neck. So I've always viewed pole vault. When I was in college and high school, when I saw the people pole vault, I'm like, this is by far the coolest thing I've ever seen. And also, I think the greatest form of athleticism. So, you know, and then obviously the 400 hurdles, which is a fucking awful race. Probably awful. Like the 800 and 400 hurdles. It takes a very special individual to run those races.
Yeah, I would rather do Fran unbroken than to do the 400 meter hurdles.
Yeah.
Like
it's
on that level.
Anytime you can bring in like somebody, and we had a few people, football players that came and trained with us that had been sprinters and had run in college. And we did have somebody come in who ran the 800 meter in college, and she came in, did CrossFit, and just kind of was like, this sucks. I don't want to do it anymore. And I was like, no, you don't like it. And she's like, no, I didn't like it in college. And this is actually easier than the 800 meters. So I'm good. And literally never came back. And I was like, okay, fair enough. Like, so
that's so funny.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. So as, you know, obviously you're doing your postdoc, you get in and then you get, you know, they offer you a commission and then you come in and, you know, you're working at Walter Reed. How did you, like kind of transition from this TBI concussion kind of brain stuff and really just going to sleep? I mean, it's really the natural progression, but like, how did that take you into that, to that piece?
Well, the two have always been married together for me. So I started out as a basic sleep researcher. So in graduate school, I actually worked with animal models of sleep and circadian rhythms. Basically, we were looking at the relationship between how the sleep cycles of mice influence drug-seeking behavior. And so we basically did like genetic manipulations of the sleep cycles to make these animals addicted to drugs, essentially. And then would give them like all different kinds of pharmaceuticals to reduce their drug intake. And so then when I was a postdoc, I was doing something very similar where we were manipulating the genetic framework of sleep. And actually through that found that sleep, some aspects of sleep, particularly sleep deprivation and your ability to recover from it, is actually regulated by the skeletal muscle. So there's a protein factor in the skeletal muscle that only exists there and nowhere else in the body or the brain. And so it's through that framework that has sort of shaped the rest of the work I've done to include TBI. Because a lot of times when I think researchers go after a disease state and they target a specific physiological system, they don't do good justice to like understand the nuances of that system.
Power Athlete Nation, this episode is brought to you by 8 Sleep. Summer's in full effect and it is hot here in Texas. And when I say hot, I mean hot, hot. And the best way to sleep is at 55 degrees with the 8 Sleep pod cover. This thing allows the bed to get icy, and there's nothing better on a hot night than slipping into an icy cold bed. Now, there's a few features of this thing that are absolute game changers. One, it's a pod cover, so it fits on top of your present mattress. Anybody that's been in the market and had to go out and shop for a new mattress, complete pain in the ass, because you usually have a significant other or a friend or whoever sleeps with you that decides, hey, this is the temperature I like firmer, I like softer, so you can keep your mattress. It's a pod cover that fits on top. Also, it's split zone. So let's say I like to sleep at 55 degrees and my wife likes to sleep at 65. We can have separate temperatures, which just makes everybody happy. And then also for the performance crowd, which I'm kind of a geek, I like to know all of the different sleep metrics out there. It gives me how long I slept, how restful, how many breaths, and most importantly, my HRV, which I can track. So allows me to know how restful and how well I sleep. It also has some custom tuning with different temperatures that gets really deep in the weeds with this thing. It's as good a system as I've ever seen. So if you're interested in checking out the 8 Sleep pod cover, you can use the code 8sleep.com/powerathlete for $150 off. I recommend you check it out. I'm not only telling you about it, I'm also a user every single night and I'm sold on 8 Sleep. Check it out.
Yeah, so that's really what shaped the framework for my TBI research, is because I had such a deep understanding of sleep physiology and the dynamics of how the brain and how the body recovers from sleep deprivation and the factors, the biological factors inside the brain and outside the brain that feed into sleep deprivation. That made going after this TBI work a lot easier. You know, and basically from this, we found that just having a single TBI causes irreversible changes in sleep. Like even long after, and we were looking at football players, mostly from Johns Hopkins, University of Maryland, as well as soldiers. And we found in a lot of our studies that long after these football players and these soldiers are returning to duty or returning to play, there are still permanent changes in their sleep, and that they have a difficult time entering the most restorative stages of sleep. And they have more you know, wakefulness across a night of sleep. So it's sort of creating this vicious cycle, right? Because these individuals need the restorative properties of sleep in order to recover, from the anabolic hormone release to the actual, you know, recovery down to the level of the cell, but they can't get that because of the brain injury. And so that's really the framework for a lot of our research.
So what's the piece on skeletal muscle? That's an interesting piece. You said that there's something within the skeletal muscle that improves upon the circadian rhythm, or did I mess that up?
No, that's actually correct. So one second. Okay, I'm hoping that's the last one.
What's going on?
Oh, there is a garbage truck here that is emptying all the dumpsters.
So funny story, when we were at Old Power Athlete in Costa Mesa, for some reason, every time we did the podcast, there would be a trash truck that would come and like do like crazy recycling, to the point where we wouldn't see the guy for like 2 weeks. And for some reason, the minute we got on the podcast, the dude would just be like backing back and forth, lights, the whole deal.
Yeah, you know what? That's exactly what it is. I was like, oh, this is the, because we have a lot of like helicopters and just different equipment that like fly over. So I try to like get in the one area that's quiet. And of course, there's this dumpster truck just hanging out.
Just happened to do their work. All right. So skeletal, skeletal muscle and circadian rhythm. I mean, just observationally, I mean, muscle's more insulin sensitive, fat's more oxidative. It would make sense. The more muscle you carry, theoretically, the better all the systems would work.
Yeah. So we basically use this genetic model. There is this protein factor that is important for maintaining the circadian rhythm. And without this protein factor, like any human, any animal is arrhythmic. They don't have any rhythms in their hormones. They don't have any rhythms in their digestive systems, and certainly no rhythms in their sleep. And the factor is called BMOL1, which stands for brain and muscle-like factor. And it got this name because it's highly expressed in both the brain and the muscle, even though it's in other tissues of the body. And so we actually found that if you genetically manipulate this protein factor in the skeletal muscle and only the skeletal muscle, that's when you see the changes and resiliency to sleep deprivation. So if you overexpress this protein factor, BMOL1 in skeletal muscle, these mice are like super soldiers, truly. Like, you could sleep deprive them and they basically have a very small recovery response from sleep deprivation, which basically means that they don't need as much sleep after sleep deprivation to make up for the lost sleep. They actually, weirdly enough, make up a lot of their lost sleep during the time they're awake, because there's certain changes in their brain architecture that sort of repays back that sleep debt. It's a very weird genetic anomaly that like a few gifted individuals are probably endowed with.
Did you find any humans with this genetic modification?
So there is one study that has found this phenotype in humans, but it's, you know, in humans, we're not at the point yet where we're doing genetic editing of actual tissue. So like whole body, single point mutation change in this gene in humans leads to this phenotype, but there's no, you know, tissue specific change identified yet, which makes sense. But you know, to be determined, because genetic editing is very much a real thing.
Yeah, no. And anybody that's interested in that stuff, they're doing that CRISPR deal where they're doing the genetic editing. If you ever read any like articles or kind of the research that they're putting out, I just wonder, that's the stuff they're actually publishing. I want to know what they're doing behind closed doors that they're not publishing.
Yeah.
You know, because there was like some weird stuff that they were doing. I know it was somewhere in like Malaysia or Thailand where all of a sudden they found some genetic mutations against certain things. And then they just started kind of like putting it out on people and not telling them. I mean, it's super soldier stuff.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, we actually have rules and regulations. And so we're limited in the scope of our discoveries, which, you know, they need to exist. But yeah, I'm sure there are some countries out there that have already solved this or made this scientific discovery.
Yeah, but that basically these guys don't need to sleep. So what's interesting about the body, and you know this, like when something like that happens, the body ends up always searching for homeostasis. So then something else happens. You know, they found that like the big one was like all the myostatin blockers. That was an interesting one. They, you know, figured out a way to block myostatin. So then they were blocking it in individuals. And then all of a sudden, the body wouldn't let them absorb nutrients. So like a small piece of bread would make people full for 2 or 3 days.
Yep.
You know, so the body's really, really interesting. Just when you think you've solved one problem, like 400 other problems come up.
Yeah, no, and exactly, this is exactly how this is, because there's like all these downstream effects too. But it looks like all these downstream effects are positive effects that you would want in a soldier. So in addition to having like resiliency to sleep deprivation, when you overexpress this protein factor in skeletal muscle and only skeletal muscle, these mice, if you like expose them to an endurance test, like they will literally run for hours. Like the average mouse, if you put them on the treadmill, will run like 20 minutes until they're exhausted. These mice will run for like over 4 hours before they are slightly exhausted. They also, we did like body composition. Believe it or not, there's a way to do like body composition in mice. It's called echo MRI. They, you know, thrive on fat metabolism. So they're not, you know, glycogenic, glucose producing, they're wired to be burning fat. So the endurance piece makes sense. They're also incredibly lean too. So it's kind of like we genetically engineered the lean mean fighting machine without intending to, but it now exists.
Well, rats are not obese by nature. And I remember looking at a bunch of the studies that, you know, whenever they do rat studies, the way they make obese rats is they basically were injecting them with MSG, monosodium glutamate.
Right.
And they'll like, they'll triple their size in like a short amount of time.
Yeah, no. And that is true too. So there is not like a direct human translation, but I mean, man, if we could, like, again, I know genetic editing is out there. But if there was any gene that, you know, if a general came to me and was like, Major Brager, I would love for you to like pick one gene that we could genetically engineer, it would definitely be this gene, BMAL1. I've worked on a lot of different systems and single point mutations and genetic protein factors for the last 20 years, but BMAL1 is certainly it definitely could be a game changer for warfare.
Oh no. I mean, just for life, be great. You're like, I don't really have to sleep anymore. And then when I do sleep there's a feedback loop that allows me to cure, basically knock out my sleep debt as I exercise or do other things.
Exactly. Yeah.
A couple of years ago, I was contacted by this group called Amsterdam New Genomics, and they did a genetic profile on me. And the hilarious part was, I get a call from the doc who's, you know, a Harvard MIT guy that's doing the whole study. And I have something that's called muscle AMP deamylase deficiency, like 100%.
Okay.
I have this genetic phenotype. And pretty much the guy calls me and he's like, you know, you have this 100%. And I'm like, well, is it dangerous? He's like, yeah, it's really dangerous because any form of exercise will result in extreme muscle soreness to the point where you can't be able to walk. And if you continue to exercise, you'll get rhabdomyolysis and die. And
you're
so,
like, bro, I was a professional athlete.
Yeah. And then I told the dude, I was like, yeah, I played in the NFL for 10 years and I competed in the CrossFit Games. And like went through this whole thing and the dude got real silent. And I was like, what do you think? And he's like, it's just another day of me realizing how little we know about genetics. He's like, you 100% have this. And based upon this, he sent me all the research. I mean, these people had like such severe muscle soreness that just like walking around the block would cripple them. And if they exercised, they would have this. And he's like, there's something obviously upstream that has completely blocked this. So he goes, you know, and then he got into the gut and he's like, you know, for every piece of bacteria, which there's more bacteria in the gut than there are cells in the body, we can see up to 400 different gene expressions.
Yeah.
So
no, it's absolutely true.
So he's like, you know, everybody was all about this idea of genetics and we're going to map the human genome. And he's like, every day we learn how much, how little we don't know. And this is just another instance of it. So I like pulled it up and I still laugh about it when you read it, the symptoms. It's like, it's heavily associated with rhabdomyolysis, increased serum creatine kinase, and a bunch of other gnarly stuff. So yeah, and I have 100% have this. So the guy just kind of shrugged his shoulders and he's like, well, keep doing what you're doing. You're fine.
I'm surprised he didn't use that, leverage that opportunity to do a case study on you.
I asked him about it and he's like, you know, every day when we do this genetics, and it's kind of like, it's more of a research thing where they get the, you know, your genetic profile. And then I get like probably a weekly update of research that's associated with things that are in my genetic profile. So it's not like, mm-hmm. you know, these other people that are like, oh, here's your genes. It's like, okay, here's your genetic profile and here's all the research associated with your genes. And so it's not necessarily like, hey, do this or this, you're at risk for this. It's like, hey, here's, you know, 100 people that were studied and you have, and this is in common. So I get a bunch of genetic stuff on myself and my wife and then my dad and my son and my kids. I just did it for everybody. And it's just interesting research because I geek out on research. So it was cool for me.
No, I mean, I think every athlete, I think we talked about this last time I was on the podcast, needs to have a genetic screen done to understand what kind of athlete they are. I don't know if Inside Tracker, and I think there was this one called Fit Gene, were still around, but I used my 23andMe data to sort of drive my CrossFit training because I did 23andMe years and years ago, even before I competed in the games. And, you know, I learned from it that I was actually a mixed modal athlete, which makes sense, right? I did the heptathlon, you know, whatever. I started out doing gymnastics, but I think gymnastics just built my athletic base. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, when I think about the types of workouts that favor me in CrossFit, it's certainly mixed modal endurance. It's not, I get absolutely crushed on the strength and the short burst workouts. The endurance workouts I do fairly well at, but that like hybrid, you know, metabolic grinders, that's where I shine.
Yeah. Like 800 meter run, pull up, that type of deal where it's like some body weight and then some longer type stuff.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, actually one of my favorite workouts is Helen. I love that workout.
Yeah. What's that? 400 meter runs and kettlebell, 50 kettlebell swings.
What is it? 400 meter run, 21 kettlebell swings, 21 pull-ups or 3 rounds.
Okay. Yeah. Now it just feels like a bad dream. All these, like whenever I think of all these CrossFit, girl workouts and these workouts that we used to do, it feels like a bad, like an interesting time in my life. I like choose to kind of mentally block out.
Yeah, I know. It's true. That actually, it does make me sad though. Now with some of the, like, I mean, obviously there is so much research around, training protocols and paradigms today. And obviously that's what you're, company does, is it takes the best evidence-based practices and creates optimal training programs. But it does make me sad that a lot of like general CrossFit boxes don't program the girls' workouts anymore. Like it's very rare that a girl's workout is programmed even in like a general population gym.
I find that disappointing as well. I mean, those were always like the benchmarks. You know, you had
exactly,
I mean, there was obviously programming, but it was kind of the way that, you know, CrossFit gyms across the world could compare themselves. Like, hey, we're doing this at programming, but here are these periodic kind of standardized, you know, girl workouts. And I remember Glassman telling me, where I asked him, I'm like, you know, how come they're named after girls? And he's like, because hurricanes are usually named after women for the same reason that CrossFit workouts are named after women and fallen heroes. And I was like, okay, yeah, makes sense. But those were always good benchmarks where all of a sudden you see the guy doing the 59-second Fran and everybody's done Fran and you're watching the video and you're like, I can't believe the dude just did that in 59 seconds.
Yep. Well, it's just like, I remember Dan Bailey, he was like one of the first to do Grace Unbroken. And you're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
I mean, now that's like a piece of cake for people. Well, not, I mean, like the games athletes, you know.
No, I watch the games athletes and it's amazing to see how far they've evolved. And more importantly, how all the athletes have specialized. Like all of a sudden you have like, you know, the girl that can squat 400 pounds, who's just, you know, can do, you know, heavy this and muscle ups and this. And then you see the other girls that are more kind of track based where, you know, they're going to get into the run and the body weight stuff, or, you know, maybe the lighter. So it's really interesting to see how the girls have just kind of partitioned themselves into like, hey, I'm really good at this. I'm going to suffer through this. I'm just going to kind of get through, but I'm going to win this. So it's really interesting on the specialization, where I felt early on, everybody was kind of adept a little bit at everything.
Yeah. Yep. And it's definitely changed. And I think, you know, that just from how you program, like, you know, your training paradigms too.
Yeah. It's, but you know, anytime you put money in competition and all these things, you're going to have specialization and people that just, you know, this is what I do, but it's, I still enjoy it. And having done it, I'm sure like you watch it, you can still be like, oh God, I know exactly how hard this is. Whereas I think unless you've done CrossFit or at least competed or done something at a high level, it's just real easy to cast stones. And, you know, we got in this discussion yesterday. We had David Weck on the podcast, and he was the inventor of the BOSU ball. And was talking about all the hate that the BOSU ball has gotten. And I kind of shrugged my shoulders because I used it for my shoulder rehab. I just kind of thought, like, honestly, and I felt so, well, kind of a little dumb in that I thought that the company that invented the physio ball invented those. They just cut them in half so they were stackable, like in the corners at gyms. I didn't know that.
That's actually pretty intuitive. Yeah. I would think the same.
Because I don't know if you've ever been to like a 24-hour fitness, like you go into like the aerobics room and they would always have like these like, you know, big corner catchers for all the physio balls. And then I went in there one time and I saw the BOSU ball and I was like, oh, they just cut them in half so they're stackable. Oh, that's really smart. And then as he's going through like how he invented it, I was like, man, I feel so stupid. I just thought that some 24-hour fitness guy was like, well, just cut them in half and they're stackable, so I don't have to chase these things around. So that was, I was like, shit, I feel dumb on this. But
well, I'll have to listen to that podcast.
He's an interesting dude. He talked for 3 hours and I got no words in. Seriously. Smart dude. But, you join the army, they come in, and then obviously your research on sleep, how has your research and really your directive changed the way that the army views sleep and more importantly, implement this across the force?
I think in our world, especially where I was at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research, their mission has always been to understand the negative consequences of sleep loss, and not just like basic stuff where you give people a neuropsych exam or test, like actually deep mechanistic biological studies where you're doing fMRI, you're doing PET imaging, you're looking at cellular metabolites, you're looking at things at the level of the cell in the brain that are changing and in some cases irreversible with chronic sleep loss. So really that's what we use for messaging. It's like, I don't want to call it fear mongering, but like we're the bad news bears. Like we show people what happens when you don't sleep. And we do use, you know, unfortunate accidents that have happened as a result of fatigue to carry out our message. We do try to sugarcoat it with some positive reinforcement, like, you know, that whole like, this is how you get a good night of sleep. Like we do try to spoon feed those strategies to getting a good night of sleep. But really, it's through like painting the worst case scenario. That's how I think we're able to get people to listen, especially if you talk about testosterone. Like I'm very happy that like, it just came to me. I think we were working with Towson University's football team. And in 2016, I was like, you know what? I got to think about the things that matter to college dudes. And I was like, what matters? Oh, testosterone and, you know, their ability to get girls, right? And it's like, so I just shaped that messaging around that. And honestly,
it's not a bad way to go. I mean, I've never met a guy that's like, oh, I don't care about testosterone. And yeah, even if they don't necessarily know what testosterone is, which I'm sure 99% of people be like, I don't know what it is. I just know that I need more of it. And it's bad if I don't have a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
We interrupt this episode with a shameless self-promotion. Power Athlete delivers battle-tested performance programming for every kind of athlete. So do you want to go from average Joe to MVP? Then dominate with Field Strong. Get stacked and jacked with Jack Street. Hustle in life and still build muscle with Grindstone. Fear no opponent with Dragon Slayer. Be harder than coffin nails with Hammer. Max out minimal equipment with Lean Enable. Or unlock those newbie gains with Bedrock. Get over to powerathletehq.com/training and choose your 7-day free trial right here, right now. Get lifting, get training, get in shape, all while listening to the rest of this show.
So again, it goes back to like knowing your audience and knowing what's going to get your unit fired up. And, you know, I think the biggest change we've made now is embedding these tactics into leadership. Like that's where we, you know, go above and beyond academics. And I see that now because I just came back from our annual sleep medicine conferences. We're not only doing the scientific discoveries, but now we're actually also doing the application and, you know, actively changing the operational tempo in the daily battle rhythm of a unit and trying to find time points where they can have an opportunity to take a nap, like I told you I used to do with my soldiers when I was in command, or to have the opportunity to work out in the middle of the day instead of waking up super early to do it. So I think that's where we have had the greatest impact too, is having those direct touch points with leaders.
Has it been a hard sell for leadership to try to emphasize sleep? I mean, when the culture of the military has probably been like, you'll sleep when you're dead. And, you know, there's also this, like I call it the Jocko effect, where, you know, like Jocko's up at 4:30 and I don't really, I'm not to say he's not, because he probably is.
But he's a genetic anomaly. Hello.
Well, but he's also a SEAL. So he's kind of tip of the spear. And I know a lot of those guys that are SEALs, like Parsley and, you know, these dudes that are in their 40s and 50s, like that was the culture. And I found, I know, cause I train at 6 a.m. Even on the days I sleep, I try to sleep in, I still wake up at like maybe 5:22, 5:23. It's to the point where like you roll over and you're like, fuck. Could I just fucking sleep past 6 o'clock? And, you know, I'll go in and like, if I don't go in and wake up my kids, they'll probably sleep till noon. And then they'll like wake up and be like, what's going on? I'm like, did you guys just sleep for like 14 hours? Like
they need it. Growing brain, growing body.
My dad would get pissed and he would bang on our doors and call us lazy fucks if we slept past like 7 o'clock. But like, I see the kids and like, frankly, I'm jealous, but I also realize, you know, the need for sleep and this. And so I just let them sleep. But I wonder if, you know, the Army and the military is changing, but it's like trying to turn a battleship, right? Like, I mean, or a aircraft carrier, but, you know, we were at the H2F deal when the program lead got up and spoke. It felt like he was in this progressive movement, but they were still trying to battle through some of the SOPs and some of the fixed pieces of the Army. So is it something where like the Jocko effect is not going to change these individuals? We just got to hopefully have them just retire and then, you know, bring in maybe a new set of individuals.
I think it's, I mean, I think you need a healthy mix of both, right? You know what I mean? Like, I don't think every single week of every single point in the training calendar, you need to be waking up at 6 a.m. waking up at 4 a.m. to do PT at 6 a.m. It has its time and place, right? Because that's how you teach discipline, accountability, and teamwork. You know, like General Tahan, she was talking about waking up the warrior spirit. It is so amazing when you do like a battalion run and you're doing the running cadence, and you know, those are the days that make you love being in the military, and they have their time and place from teaching those attributes that the military most values. But outside of those, like, touch points, maybe, you know, 1 week or 2 weeks every month. The rest of the month should be about letting people do get their fitness in, but as long as you trust them that they will get their fitness in, to let them do it on their own accord. And I think that's where H2F is seeing its greatest value, because technically those facilities and those coaches are available at all hours of the duty day, right? So why not take advantage of that? And I think it will take a change of leadership. You are right to drive that change, but those next generation leaders have to put into work in order to make it happen. You know, like I talked about how when I first told my brigade commander that I was going to implement nap time and that I created a fatigue management policy, and that I was going to change how we shape when and how our trucks are on the road. You know, he thought I was super entitled. I was just this AMED doctor coming in, telling the operational commander what to do. And, you know, I didn't have a deployment patch and I didn't have the bells and whistles on my uniform. But I knew better because I was in school for a long time. So I had to change my approach. And so once I was able to show return on investment and how much happier and how much greater morale was in a unit that had an all-time low morale at the time I inherited it, that's when I was able to get senior leaders above me to appreciate the value of rest and recovery.
So for anybody that's listening, just give you some background. Allison was tasked with managing the schedules of these huge semi trucks that basically for the U.S. military that drive around America. So if you see like a huge semi go by, that's like, you know, U.S. Army. Yeah. And so what they're kind of driving around the country all year round as kind of moving billboards, but then they also set up different events. And there's kind of this logistical deal where these guys are on the road. I mean, 365 days a year. And so I think that the original mission directive was just like, drive forever, don't stop, don't sleep, eat at truck stops. And Allison came in and she's like, this is a terrible idea. We need to implement driving on this, and started creating structure, which ended up making it more efficient. And those guys ended up doing better.
Yep. Yeah. Honestly, I think the saving grace for those guys before I got in was the fact that they could sleep in hotels. So thank God they weren't sleeping at like truck stops or barracks. They could actually like stay in a hotel when they were at their event. And like a lot of them ended up, you know, buying an air fryer or like buying, you know, portable cooking equipment so they could cook their own meals because they got tired of eating out. But besides that, like this mission was a recipe for disaster. Like it was insane how little rest days they actually got from outside of driving. Cause I mean, here's the thing. Everyone likes road trips here and there, but to drive 585 miles a day, every day for like your 3 years that you're on this detail, that's awful.
No, that sounds awful.
And you're also driving something that literally will kill everyone and everything on the road.
Yeah. So I'm basically driving a 40,000 pound truck around, heavily redacted of anything that looks like longevity, sleep, and more importantly, community. I mean, it's, that's gotta be a pretty terrible mission deployment. And you're like, hey, so where'd you go? Afghanistan? No, I drove trucks around America.
Yep.
Wow.
Hey, watch, all of the listeners are going to see one now.
Well, after you mentioned it, I've probably seen two.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
They're around Texas, Florida.
Yeah.
Like they're down south a lot.
And I saw them. I totally honked and waved and the guys were like waving back. And I was like, man, these poor guys. So yeah. One of the slides that I took a picture of that you presented at the HTO2F deal was establishing an optimal sleep environment. And I wanted to get into a little bit of the research and kind of the different pieces of that. You had it broken down into time pre-bed and then the activity. So the first one was 90 minutes before bed, no more work. So shutting down work. 60 minutes was no phone or TV. 30 was low level activity, dim, and then zero, obviously cool, dark, quiet room.
Yep. Yeah. So this is a strategy that has been touted and, you know, evidence-based for a very long time. This is what cognitive behavioral therapists use to help people who have insomnia. But we can now just take these basic behavioral changes that were intentionally designed to help people who have insomnia and apply it to the general population. At the end of the day, when it comes to certain sleep disorders like insomnia, and even things like nightmare disorder, it's really the behavioral interventions that are going to resolve these issues. It's not taking a pill or any other form of treatment. It's truly like being self-aware of your daily waking routine and how it impacts or potentially could impact your sleep at night. And so, yeah, these strategies that this, you know, 90, 60, 30, 10, they work for a lot of people, especially if in the military, right? When you're used to being told what to do. And even for athletes that, you know, at the end of the day, we like being told what to do, as long as we're trusting the individual who's telling us what to do. But yeah, they're deeply rooted in science. And like I said, the parameters in terms of like how dark the room is, how cool the room should be, which is between like 66 and 69 degrees. You know, that all came about from research studies in the lab and actually studies that NASA did too. So those parameters and those guidelines came directly out of the Directorate of Fatigue Management from NASA.
Okay. So, you know, whether or not it's you guys or, you know, the Army or, you know, Doc Parsley or any of these sleep experts, it's always this kind of golden 7 to 8 hours of sleep. The problem I run into is even though I might be in bed for 7 or 8 hours of sleep, I really am kind of just below the threshold of 6 hours total of sleep, you know, because, with the Whoop, they subtract kind of time away.
Yep.
So if I go to bed at, you know, 9:30 and I wake up at 5:30, you know, that should give me my 8 hours. But for the most part, I'm right at that like threshold of like 5:59, 5:40, 5:50. And, you know, I'll end up having an hour 40 of awake time. So, I mean, but for the, you know, I'd end up doing probably almost 40% of my total sleep time in REM or deep sleep. So that's pretty good.
Perfect. That's absolutely perfect. You want to have both of those combined to make up about 40 to 45% of your total sleep time.
So how, I don't know how to increase it. I've been messing with like, supplements. I have, like a cooling pad on my bed. I mean, fan, tried different things, change pillows, but for the most part, it's pretty consistent right at that, like 6 hours of total sleep. And even if I'll go to bed, like last night I was smoked, I trained 3 times. I did, my zone 2 conditioning in the morning. I trained the fighters at 2 with them. And then I went to Jits for like 90 minutes last night, got home, ate dinner and was fucking smoked. Went to bed at like 9:15, still woke up at 5:23. And when I looked, it was like, you know, 5 hours and 59 minutes of sleep. And I'm like, fuck, like I cannot break this 6 hour barrier. And I don't know if it's like stressing me out that I'm wearing these wearables that are almost reinforcing that I'm not able to get more than 6 hours of sleep. And I don't, you know, but then when you read all the research, it's like 7 to 8 hours of sleep, but there's a difference obviously between time in bed and actual sleep.
Yeah, no, I mean, there is a bell curve, right? You know, the average human needs 8.4 hours of sleep. I would say my go-to is like 7.5 for the same reasons, like everything you describe, like, I need at least 7.5. And if I am in bed longer than 7.5 hours, I can't, you know, I can't go back to sleep. But the big question to ask is when you wake up the next day, do you feel rested and recovered? Because that's the key. You may be somebody because of your genetic physiological set point, a shorter sleeper. But as long as you wake up and you feel rested, you feel recovered, and you don't feel like you need to get through the day with stimulants, then everything is fine. Like, you know, it goes back to this idea of homeostasis, right? Your body is figuring out a way to pay back its sleep that it acquires across the waking day. within that 6 hours of actual sleep, because your restorative sleep amounts reflect that.
Okay. Yeah, no, it's, I think for the majority of sleep, you know, obviously I like taping my mouth has been a real big one, especially on like the sleep cadence and breaths per minute.
Yeah.
But unless you have some form of sleep tracking, it's next to impossible, because you're like, oh, I was in bed by 9:30. I got up at 5:30, and then that's how much sleep I got. Where people, so it's been really fascinating to wear some of the wearables. I also wonder how accurate they are, and more importantly, if there's like a stress factor for the wearables, where now all of a sudden I feel pressure based upon these numbers, and then it's constantly reinforcing it through the day for me.
Oh, there absolutely is. You know, I'm the first to admit that, you know, I think you need to take holidays from your wearables. You know, even as someone who, like, full disclosure, you know, I sit as a unpaid government liaison on Whoop's advisory board. There's anxiety around wearing the Whoop, and, you know, you just have to, you have to use it when you need it and then take it off. You know, especially if you're like, I was in Australia last week for work. I had to take it off because I knew that no matter, even if I felt good, my recovery was probably going to be, you know, in the red the entire time, even if I was trying to do everything right, because of just being that far away for such a short period of time.
I keep getting, I keep getting recovery numbers in the 80s and like the high 80s on, like, they're like, you did not get the optimal amount of sleep. You got 5 hours and 15 minutes of sleep, but for some reason your recovery is like 89, which,
yeah, I know. Yeah. They need to work on that stuff.
Yeah. I'm like, okay, so I'm underslept, but for some reason. So that's, it's kind of confusing, and it's a lot of information. And then you start kind of getting into this, and it's got a really good addiction kind of factor. I think that they probably worked with some people from Vegas to try to like give you enough information to kind of have you do it. But I really think, the Apple Watch too actually makes it, I don't know if it makes it better or worse, but it, yeah, it feels like a lot. You brought up something about NASA. So
yes.
Was there, I mean, from what we discussed briefly, there was a chance that you might be an astronaut.
Yes, I'm going to go back through the pipeline next year, hopefully. So I went through the pipeline the first time.
Okay, so what happened?
I made it to the second final round, and I didn't make it any farther. I went to NASA.
You were too qualified. You were too qualified.
Oh, everyone I was there with was like a superhuman with a very unique superpower. I truly don't know how they chose in the end. I can't imagine how difficult it is, because everyone, there was not a single person of the 120 finalists I met there that was not, like, everyone there was deserving to be there, like, far and beyond. I mean, you basically found like the 120 best people in every profession around the country to like be there to compete. So, you know, I was disappointed I didn't get selected, but at the end of the day, like, the people I was competing against, like, you know, you have to be a good sport about that.
So what's can you get into the pipeline? I've always been fascinated, you know, one, on the selection process, but once you get there, what the, you know, like what that pipeline looks like. I mean, I imagine, like, I know this is terrible, but like the movie Armageddon, where they pick these dudes up and they put them through all the psychological stuff and the training, but I've always just been fascinated by that piece.
No, there's a lot of that too. Actually, we had our first, like, quote unquote assignment when we were flying there to Houston. Like, I got a text like, hey, just so you know, this is your first assignment. Please have it done by the end of the day tomorrow. So, like, you know, they strategically knew when we were all flying there, so we'd get the text when we land. So we'd have to, you know, start right away. So basically, you can apply through the military or just as a civilian through usajobs.gov. And I know NASA did like advertisements on pretty much like radio and some, you know, PBS and stuff like, hey, do you want to be an astronaut? We're accepting applications. It was like March 20th of 2020. So that's actually when I applied. It was like literally right after COVID started. Is when the pipeline opened up. And so they basically had 12,000 applicants from civilians and then all the military services. But with military, we get preference And so you actually have to submit an additional packet through your branch of service. And then the current astronauts who represent your branch pick and choose who they want to move forward to NASA. So I was selected by Colonel Drew Morgan and soon to be Colonel Frank Rubio, who I'm actually talking to tomorrow from the International Space Station. We have a leadership professional development talk with him. And so I actually get to, like, you know, obviously he knows I didn't get selected because I'm sure he found out who got selected, but, you know, tell him I'm sorry I let him down tomorrow, but it's okay.
Yeah, no. So, okay. So the selection process happens based upon 12,000 applicants. You get there and it's in Houston, and then what? Is it like, is it psychological, physical, all of the above? I mean,
yes, it's all of the above. I made it to the round of 120. So they go down from like 12,000 to 120. I don't know how they decide within that interim period. But I was basically, I got a call from NASA. I was actually out at Power Monkey coaching, and they couldn't get a hold of me because there's like zero reception out where Power Monkey camp is. And so finally I got the phone call, and NASA's like, hey, you made it to the round of 120. Like, let's get you booked to come here for 2 weeks. So basically you spend 2 weeks there doing psychological assessments, a few physical assessments. It's a lot of poking and prodding for medical things. That's really what the first round is. And then from there, they invite back 40 people. And then from that 40, they choose 10 astronaut candidates who are in basically training to become, go on a mission someday. So they're not called astronauts yet because they still have like some secondary selection they have to go through once they become an astronaut candidate. But, and then, yeah, you also have an interview too, which was really cool to think about now. Like basically they put you in the center room and there's 21 astronauts of the 42 or 44 in the core surrounding you in a circle. And they just ask you questions for an hour. And it was pretty cool because literally three of the four people in that room were selected for the moon mission. So it's like really cool to know that, like, I got to, you know, interview with them there, but then they also have like happy hour and stuff. Some of the nights that you're staying at the hotel near NASA. So you get to like meet and greet the astronauts over like, you know, wine and beer too. So it was a pretty cool experience, and I hope I have it again and make it a little bit further next time.
We know your health and wellness are a priority. That's why we partnered with Stay Classy Meats. They are dedicated to connecting you with the finest responsibly raised meats on the planet. Their direct partnerships with farmers and ranchers mean they can deliver to you nationwide. They're more than a meat company. They're a network of athletes and farmers committed to superior nutrition. Stay Classy works with producers like R.C. Carter, whose regenerative agricultural practices result in beef that's packed with 75% more essential amino acids, phytonutrients, and a perfect blend of omega-3-6 ratio. Experience the difference with their 10-pound ground beef or 15-pound assorted meat subscription box, specially branded as the Stay Classy Power Athlete box. Click on the link and order today with the promo code POWERATHLETE, all one word. Join us in securing your health and food supply chain. Stay Classy Meats, superior nutrition, naturally. It's time to step up your game. Stay classy with us. What was like the physical requirements? Was there a conditioning test, VO2 max, underwater? Like, I just wonder like how, like the physicality. I mean, you have to be physically fit to be able to handle, basically getting shot in a rocket up to the moon, and then probably like the physical aspect of being in that gravity. I just wonder if like that becomes like the huge break point where, you know, hey, like, are you physically fit enough to do this job?
So they have, I'm not sure what they ended up doing in the end, but when I was there, we were supposed to do the astronaut corps has their own version of a fitness test. I don't know what the specific acronym is, but it's just like the ACFT, but for astronauts. We were supposed to do it, but we were there during COVID. So like, just like the rest of the Army wasn't doing the ACFT during that time, we didn't have to like do that as part of a selection. Now, I do know that when the next group came back, that I didn't get selected for, they had to go through this obstacle course maze and like a planner position. So basically they were suspended on these wires and they were horizontal and they had to like maneuver through space and different obstacles. But those are the only two, I guess, tests I'm tracking. It's just, I will say I am a little bummed I didn't get to do the astronaut fitness test, because I know that's where I would have shined. And I will say I did get a compliment, though, that I'm going to use as like a icebreaker now, though, is when the woman who was doing my bone scan, she apparently has bone scanned every single astronaut or astronaut candidate or hopeful since 1984. And she told me that, she asked me what I did. And I was like, well, I was a gymnast my whole life. Then I did CrossFit. And she's like, I have never seen bone density on a woman like you. She's like, the only other woman I've ever seen bone density like this on is Sally Ride. And I was like,
oh, nice.
Oh, thank you. So apparently I have the bone density of Sally Ride.
You're like, it's kind of your icebreaker. Like, have I told you about my bone density? What was it? It was either DEXA scans. Years ago, we had this deal come, and when they do the DEXA, they look at bone scans, and I can't remember who it was, but one of the guys is like, oh, mine's, you know, like 97th percentile. It's great. And then we all got tested and we were all 99th percentile. And we're like, oh, I guess, you know, because he was talking shit about it. He's like, oh, I'm 97th percentile in the bone density. Then we all got done and everybody was like 99%. So it kind of became this like running joke for the bone density deal. But
mic drop.
What's the astronaut physical fitness test?
You know what? I don't even know. You caught me on the spot.
Okay. Well, you said you were excited to do it. I mean, which would make you a crazy CrossFitter that you're like, I don't know what it is, but I'm excited to do it because it can't be more awful than competing in the games.
Exactly. It was the unknown and the unknowable. Yeah. Even for our interview, like mask at that point, like mask was optional. We did have to wear our mask like here and there in a few places. And like, you know, they try to make it as open as possible, despite the restrictions during the time. I mean, it was 2021, and granted, it is Texas, but there still were, you know, restrictions that NASA was trying to adhere to, especially since the military was still wearing their mask at that time. Yeah. But yeah, I wish I would have known what the test was. I could tell you if I make it that far next time and they take us through it. So
have you reapplied?
So I have to wait until, I think, next spring is when the pipeline reopens. So it's every 4 years.
Oh, yep. Badass. Nice.
Yeah.
All right. So for the final round, if I was going to ask you as, you know, Army's expert, renowned expert on sleep, what's the low-hanging fruit? If people are listening to this podcast and they think like, okay, here's three things that I can do today to potentially improve the outcome of my sleep, whether it be hydration, salt, bed, technology, supplements, like how, like what's some of the really low hanging fruit that people can take away? Cause you know, for a lot of, let's say, you know, the Huberman podcast and this, it's always very theoretical, but I'm always like, what's like the actionable item that the person listening to this podcast can be like, hey, I'm going to implement this today. Allison is, you know, world expert, and here's the one piece that they can implement.
Well, I will say it's theoretical because he has taken a lot of the research from sleep and circadian rhythms over the last 30 years.
But
and,
you actually work like you're not in a, like you, while you are in a lab, I mean, you actually work with soldiers or on the ground. And, you know, like I think the lab and the rat studies is always great, but you know, like when you have a pool like the Army where, you know, they, by nature, they're required to do what you tell them. For the most part, I just wonder what that is. And that, I mean, the energy drink one absolutely blew my mind because I've been telling everybody that energy drinks are the death of people.
So that's my number one, is lay off the energy drinks, replace it with coffee or something that is more naturally sourced caffeine. And that is out there, right? Like those FitAid caffeine drinks, the Celsius, those have like the standard acceptable suitable amount of caffeine. It's the Monsters, the Reigns, and the Bangs, which I think Bang went under, so they're not really around anymore. those have way too much caffeine, and then it has all that additive chemical stuff. That's where the neurotoxicity comes into play. Just like you were talking before about MSG, which is also neurotoxic. Like, those energy drinks are laden with neurotoxic chemicals. So that's my first thing, is lay off the energy drinks. It is possible, because I was able to change the energy drink consumption of the Army esports gaming team. So when I was on the CrossFit team, we had a professional team of esports athletes, and they literally, they used to drink so much of that stuff. And then month by month, I got them to wean off, and I educated them on what it was doing to their health in the long term and short term. And I think some of them today still don't have any energy drinks at all. Like, they'll text me and be like, ma'am, thank you for changing my bad habit. So that's number one. Number two is the cooling mattress. That is the biggest low-hanging fruit game changer for anyone. Athletes, military, even general public, we tend to sleep hot. And that technology that's been developed has helped so many people. I don't know if you, I'm sure you could speak to it. I'm sure ever since you got the cooling pad, it's made a huge difference.
It's night and day. I get so excited before bed. I go in there and I turn it on and I let it get down into the 60s. And then I, you know, I brush my teeth. I usually do a big glass of water with, some natural calm, some of parsley's, sleep remedy, and then some element salt. And so I'll put that in, and I kind of just kind of chill out a little bit, brush my teeth, mouthwash, floss, do whatever I need to do in terms of the hygiene deal. And then I kind of just kind of sit down and I kind of slowly drink that and wait for it to get as cold as possible. The hilarious thing is, this morning at like 6 a.m., I heard like my son's door open, because I ended up like, there's bells on his door. So like, I can hear the, like the kids when I know they're up. So when they open the door, I'll hear like Santa bells. And so I hear the door and then I hear these like this little piddle pat, and he like basically like cannonball dives, right into bed, into the middle, and like fights to get underneath there. And then he like lays like his back, and he's like, ah, it's so cold. And so I don't have a chili pad for him, or the sleep aid, or, you know, whatever the systems. So I told him this year for Christmas, he's asked like for a bunch. I'm like, this year for Christmas, you'll get your own cooling pad. So I'd like to get it for all the kids. It's just nice. Like, he like, and then he kind of like lays there and he kind of, he like lets out this huge deal and right to sleep. And then I'm looking at him, I'll text you the picture. It's just like ninja blow dart. Like, as soon as he puts his face on it, he's out. And I'm like looking at him like, first of all, how did you fall asleep that fast? And he just loves it. And he's like, oh, can I have a cold bed like you, Dad? And I'm like, one day I will have you your own cold bed. But I think it's a game changer, because I ended up reading, this is years ago, the reason that people move so much in bed is they're constantly looking for the coldest part of the bed.
Yep. And that is absolutely true.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm a huge fan. All right. What else?
And then last thing is like dimming the lights. You know, that protocol I have of dimming the lights 30 minutes before bed. The reason that exists is because that's how you elicit the secretion of melatonin. So like, in the technical clinical term for it is DOMO, dim light melatonin onset. And that's what literally what happens. As soon as you start dimming the lights to levels that are comparable to candlelight, your brain starts secreting melatonin. So to help you fall asleep, you don't need a melatonin supplement. And in fact, it's not going to work unless you're traveling across time zones.
Yeah.
But just simply dimming the lights.
There was also some cool research. I think I got this from Parsley, that if you get direct sunlight in the morning, 14 to 16 hours later, your body will start to secrete melatonin when the light comes down. But if you don't get that direct sunlight, it kind of short circuits and that process doesn't happen.
Yeah, no, that is true too, because, you know, sunlight creates a robustness in the sleep-wake cycle. There's nothing better than daylight to create that robustness. That's something that artificial light cannot truly mimic. And we know that from, it's studies too. Like, there's a good friend of mine, he took people out camping, and because they had that direct sunlight exposure and able to create that robustness in their system, they had much more optimal melatonin secretion than people who were just following the same protocol of sleeping and waking, but in a lab and not outside.
Cool. All right. Well, I would like to reserve, if you make it to Austin, Texas, that we do this in person. I feel like
we will.
Okay. I'm going to book you for it, but I know you're going to be kind of traveling and moving around. So I'm not going to pin you on a date, but I will make you promise that if you come to Austin, we will do this in person.
Yes. No, absolutely. Awesome. I definitely need to get out there this fall.
Awesome. Well, I look forward to it. If people want to catch up with you, what's the best way to get a hold of you? I know you're big on Instagram, and it's Doc.
It's Doc Jock ZZZ, DocJockZZZ.
And then if they want to catch up with you, social media, I mean, that's the social media, but anywhere else?
That's usually all I use. I'm not a tweeter.
Yeah.
I try to keep it simple.
I like that. I dream one day of never having to have social media. I think that's how you know you've really made it. So that you can just kind of follow.
Actually, I won't have social media for the next 3 months. And like, I'm so excited. Like it's
no
so
pressure.
Funny.
You should
so sad about like being deployed or like going on special assignment. It's like, yes, I don't have to be on social media.
You need to just put up like a static one that's pinned that just says gone fishing or, do not disturb or, you know, like something to the effect. I've just always thought it'd be cool to put up like a gone fishing and then, you know, just leave it up there forever. So, well, thank you for so much for taking the time. I know it's tough fitting into your busy schedule, but, we'll plan to do this one in person. And it was great to see you recently in El Paso.
Absolutely.
And,
I know.
Well, always stoked whenever we get a chance to hang out. So thanks for tuning in another episode of Power Athlete Radio.
This episode of Power Athlete Radio is powered by Train Heroic, the most immersive strength training app experience on the market.
We've built our online training business by partnering with Train Heroic and helping us deliver all of our world-class training programs like Jack Street, Field Strong, and Grindstone. To learn which Power Athlete training program best suits your goals, head to powerathletehq.com/training.
And if you're a coach looking to build a business with the best tech and training, go to trainheroic.co/powerathletehq.